We read for you. Atlantis, the Dark Continent. A book by Paul Williamson and Linda Braithwaite. Read by JP on Wolf Spirit Radio. Atlantis, the Dark Continent. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Welcome back. This is hopefully, this is definitely the last episode. So, I think this is episode 14, and we're just finishing up of the final regressions in chapter 17, The Life of Jor-Lee. Connections. When Denise read my account of Jor-Lee for the first time, she found herself reacting particularly strongly to my sharing about Shastar's death and about the Sacred Mountain. I had perceived Denise to be my young female companion who accompanied my sister and I to the mountain sanctuary when we were forced to flee from our hometown by the harbour. I had little awareness of her presence after we reached the sanctuary. Denise felt that she had, in typical style, devoted herself to working with crystals and earth healing once she settled into the sanctuary. Because of her interest, she had been called to work at the Sacred Mountain before I, as Jor-Lee, went there. Then she returned to Shastar's sanctuary while we were still there. When the mountain sanctuary was attacked, Denise felt herself to be one of the healers whom Shastar tried to shield from the soldiers. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to protect her, and she was killed. On many occasions in Atlantis, Denise's soul has had a tendency to seek refuge in the sanctuaries rather than engage in more normal human activity. She was afraid of being hurt by people, being drawn into troublesome situations. But the sanctuaries were not always the safe places she would wish them to be. Working through her Atlanteans' past lives is helping Denise to address issues around her involvement with people in her present life. She has recognized a tendency in her present life to hide away from people, just as she did in Atlantis. This process for Denise has been complex, with many layers of emotional reactions to particular situations that have become deeply ingrained. As she is gradually releasing her fear of people and letting down her barriers to closeness with others, Denise is becoming a much more happy person as a result. I identified Lynn as the priest in Jor-Lee's life. When she read in my account about the actions of the priest, Lynn felt very unhappy. She started shaking and she felt sick and nauseous. When she read the account for the second time, she realized that she had blocked out the memories of many of the incidents of the priest's action from her first reading. Lynn felt the coldness of the priest and was very distressed by his seemingly total self-interest and lack of compassion. She could not feel his heart, and he felt very remote from her. The life of Jor-Lee was very rich with human relationships for me. I have sensed many of the other main characters in the story as people whom I know today. Some have remained a mystery. Linda, by the way, when she read the account, felt a close involvement with what was going on, as if she had been watching closely from spirit. She had a strange sense that she had been advised to take on a lifetime at this time because of its soul growth opportunity. She had a strange sense that she had been advised to take on a lifetime at this time because of its soul growth opportunities, but she had refused. Lynn's regression as the priest. After about 2 months, About 2 months after I completed my regression sessions as Jor-Lee, Linda showed Lynn a drawing she had done of boats leaving a harbour shortly before the destruction of Atlantis. Lynn did not want to look at that picture, and her body reacted immediately. All down her right side, she experienced a strong pain. Over these days, Lynn had also been having problems with her teaching job. There were occasions she noticed when she was reacting to her pupils by using excessive control in a manner that was not typical of her. From her experience, Lynn sensed that through her abnormal behavior, that it was likely that memories of a past life were wanting to come forth. By listening within, her inner senses told her that it was the life of the priest who Jolene had encountered. Lynn had dreaded the thought that she would ever need to go through this past life because it was obviously very difficult. However, now her body and inner psyche were prompting her that the time had come when she needed to process it. As we began through regression our exploration of this life, Lynn experienced herself as a young boy living in a very overcrowded city. Buildings were packed tightly together, and many people had not enough food to eat. There was a sense of general deprivation from which the population suffered. Lynn felt, as this boy, that he had been left abandoned on the street. His mother had not been able to feed him anymore, and had just left him. Through her body, Lynn could feel the fear, weakness, and helplessness of this boy. He was rescued and taken to the local healing temple, where he could live with other children. However, this was a very austere place, and he had to live under very strict conditions and obey the priests. At some stage when he grew older, there were riots in the city, and families died in disputes over food. He wanted to help the people, but the priest supervising him beat him with a stick for expressing this view. Within the temple, he was not allowed to question anything, and he would be punished if he acted differently from what was expected of him. The supervising priest told him that the people needed to be more firmly controlled and regulated so that these problems would not occur. During this long and painful beating, the boy's heart closed and became cold. He did not want anyone to control him again. He grew up to become a priest himself and adopted the attitudes of the supervising priest who had beaten him. He was clever and could easily manipulate people. He became quite arrogant in the manner that he regarded other people as fools, and he thought that his way was the right way. Soon he rose to a position where he was leading priest in the temple and a member of the ruling council within the city. His beliefs were that the people needed to become more orderly and be managed by the central authorities. Only when the people respected this and worked harder could the problems of the city be overcome. As the priest, he could do much to control the people through the activities of the temple. His main means of doing this was by manipulating the oracles. When the oracles were relaxed, he could speak to their minds and give them the correct ideas and right guidance of what they needed to say to the people. The priest felt he knew better than what the people needed. The priest felt he knew better what the people needed than what the oracles would otherwise channel. Once his thoughts were deeply implanted, the oracles would repeat them in their own words during the temple ceremonies without realizing what had happened. On one occasion, the priest came across a young woman who was resistant to his thoughts. She writhed about and seemed to be in pain as he tried to manipulate her. Then, when she channeled, her words spoke from another source than what he wanted her to say. It could be that she had the potential to be a true oracle. However, this resistance disturbed the priest greatly. Therefore, he arranged for her to be taken away and killed. With the crystals in the temple soaking up the energy from the people, the priest could feel this energy through his feet. He was sensitive to this energy and found that it could fill his body, making him feel strong and powerful. There was an addictive, compulsive quality about it, so that when he left the temple, It felt like something was missing. This energy made him feel invincible, as if he was capable of anything, and it fed his feeling and lust for power. The people were submissive and would do what he told them. When it came to the disruptions caused by Jawley and his followers, this caused great anger to the priest because it interrupted the energy flow. He could not accept what other people could think differently to him and oppose him. He could not accept that other people could think differently to him and oppose him. His rage continued until Jawley was finally captured. The priest wanted Jawley to rescind in public his opposition to the central authorities and to say that he was wrong. Jawley refused to do it. The priest tried various forms of torture, including sleep, food and water deprivation, and beatings. His favourite weapon was a wooden club made of a very hard wood. The priest could wield this expertly and was able to cause pain, bruising, agony and broken bones as he willed. The extent of this physical torture as Lin experienced it went far beyond what I allowed myself to experience when I went through my regression experience as Jawley. The priest was immensely frustrated that he could not control Jawley and bend him to his will. He desperately wanted to kill him and make him disappear, but the authorities of the council forbade him to do that. The authorities released Jawley as part of a carefully calculated plan. The priest was in charge of operations for secure outlying sanctuaries. The priest was in charge of operations to secure outlying sanctuaries and direct power and energies from their crystals into the central grid for the city. Methodically, he was succeeding with this task, but Jawley had information of hidden places he needed to know about. When Jawley escaped from the healer and old woman and made his way back to the sanctuary in the mountains, he was tracked without his knowledge all the way back to his home. The priest saved this knowledge so he would be able to use it later. Once the earth energy supply was cut off to a large extent from reaching the city, the priest's power diminished. He personally led the attack upon Jawley's sanctuary in an attempt to resurrect the energy flow to the city again. By using his wooden club and dagger, he accounted for several of the bewildered healers who were trying to resist the military presence. But this attempt to revitalize the city's energy supply failed. His dream of making the city into a showpiece of power and regulated activity was shattered. As he got older, the priest maintained his position within the temple. However, he felt very tired and weary. He did not feel that he could get enough sustenance and support from the energy anymore. The situation deteriorated, with less and less energy coming in through the crystals, and the priest felt himself weakening with it. The life of the people got no better, rather worse, and they did not listen to him anymore. The words he spoke through the oracles were not respected. The priest lived right up until the destruction of the land. As this event approached, he felt very old and tired and could sense that something was very bad. The first thing he noticed was that the energy had dropped to an even lower level. He felt fearful of what would happen. There was a feeling of dread and coldness. All around there seemed to be darkness. He was certain there was something wrong. The priest could sense an eerie and strange atmosphere. The birds and animals seemed to know something, and they were all disappearing. Birds were flying away out to sea, and not only the seabirds that would normally fly there, but other birds too. Then, as he woke up one morning, there was a shaking in the ground. Very gently at first, but not stopping, and growing in intensity. The people were becoming more and more disturbed. It was not like an earthquake which would end after some minutes. These rumblings kept on becoming more severe. Buildings were beginning to shake, and people tried to work out where it was safer. They were leaving the buildings, trying to protect themselves. As he watched all this, the priest felt tired. There was nowhere to go. He would stay in the temple. Memories came to him of the past and days when he could feel the power. However, the disturbances increased. There was a terrible sound and noise that arose. It was unbelievable in its intensity. There was noise from the rumbling of the earth beneath his feet, from fierce winds that whipped in all directions, and the sea that was churning and very upset. People were screaming and there was nowhere to hide. People came pouring into the temple, hoping this would be safe. But the priest knew that nowhere was safe. The noise that was rising higher was indescribable, really indescribable. Suddenly the temple was torn apart. The priest felt himself thrown to the ground by these earth movements. He could feel utter helplessness. There was nothing anyone could do. Within the noise, people were screaming and children crying. He felt weak, so weak, and without control. The priest could sense that the earth was splitting beneath him. Then came the awareness of fire, of molten rock erupting and streaming towards him. He could not get away, for he was trapped by some rubble that had fallen upon him. His legs were trapped. The priest could feel the heat of this lava getting closer, knowing that soon it would engulf him. He was just starting to feel its burning on his body when suddenly he was floating and leaving. It was over. Leaving that body, the priest felt very sad. He realized abilities that he had that he could have been used, that could have used. He realized abilities that he had that could have been used to help people, but he had only been interested in himself, and he had been very cruel to others. More and more people were joining him in spirit. It was overwhelming in its confusion and feelings. People bewildered and shocked, not knowing what they were doing. From having lived as this priest, there was no comfort being with these people. Somehow he felt responsible that he had contributed to their deaths and the destruction of the land. Lynn felt a very tight band of pain around her head and a shaking inside. This was very hard for her to bear. Lynn could feel a sense of failure and waste, feeling that it was her fault for what had happened. She wanted to curl up and try to be safe, much as that little boy had wanted to do when he was left abandoned on the street by his mother. Lynn recognized a tendency in herself to blame herself excessively when things went wrong. She found it very difficult to be at fault. As a conclusion to the sessions, Lynn found herself bathed in light. She was taken to a time in that life where, as a young man, he could have made a different choice. Chapter 18. Commentary. The End of Atlantis. This is a conversation between Paul and Albany. Albany is, I think, Linda's spirit guide, higher self. Paul asks, "Can you say how the situation developed from Tarsha's time towards the eventual destruction of Atlantis?" Albany replies, "It is well known that the continent of Atlantis was very rich in earth energy and crystal energy. It has a great wealth in these things, and there were great masses of crystal and beds of crystal which gave the land its tremendous life and energy and vibrancy. This was well known to the people, and the people reacted to this in many different ways. Eventually, when you have a build-up of a militaristic society, which started to happen in a very slow and gradual way, but of course gain momentum, for one thing brings another, and people will start to behave aggressively to their neighbors, their neighboring country or city or something like that. And when this happens, they desire more power. It was realized that power could be gained from the earth herself, but a lot of this knowledge was lost in the Crystal War. However, the souls who were alive then were alive later, back in bodies and still existing on the Atlantean continent. Some were not there, but quite a lot were. The knowledge was deep beneath. The knowledge was deep within them. Gradually, over a long period of time, this knowledge began to surface again. Just one or two people at first, and then that was passed on and elaborated on, and anything grows in this manner. Eventually, the people who desired power began to realize that one way of getting it was to harness this massive earth energy that was all around them all the time. Each person desired more than the person next to them, or the group or the country next to them, so began a form of corruption of this power. Opposite this was the vast network of healing sanctuaries and healers who were very, very powerful also. They tended to shy away from this kind of greed and power, but they used their energies in a positive manner, and they honoured the earth and honoured the power that she gave them, and used that energy for healing others. So you had this development of a two-level system, where the earth energy was being used, one positive and one negative. This went along for some considerable time, probably 2,000 to 3,000 years, in quite a slow and gradual manner. And as with all things, it began to increase. Knowledge was beginning to spread, and the population was getting larger. There was more competition for space, for the power of the people, for there were more people to control, and there was this combination of factors that led to the rise in the use of negative sides of the energy that contributed to its eventual downfall. Around Tasha's time, the military were beginning to gain power. There were quite a few pockets where they were powerful indeed, but others where they were not. However, this gradually changed. Eventually, the aggression of these people subjugated the more passive. The healers and the groups that were with them and the people who sympathized with the correct use of the energy tended to go to the mountains, well away from the cities where this negative energy was pulling down everything around them. They went away from the physical aggression and the physical population. It was much too crowded and difficult there to practice what they needed to practice. There were many points over the whole of the continent that were energy points, that were protected by the healers. These were well known amongst that fraternity. In general, people who needed help would still go to the mountains, to the sanctuaries, to gain that help they needed. For illness, for solace, for many reasons. But finally, I am now talking after Tasha's time and heading towards the final years. The aggressor became stronger and the others weaker, for they did not know how to fight. They did not wish to fight. And the power and energy, albeit negative, that the others generated in various forms, gave them even more energy that fed upon itself, and essentially became like a monster out of control, leading the people, leading the leaders, leading the soldiers. And they were almost under a compulsion to be greedy and take more and more of this energy and convert it to their own usage. And this is essentially is what caused the eventual breakup of the continent. Paul asks, can you tell about the main pockets where the corruption occurred? Albany replies, in the end times, the bulk of the population was where Jor-Lee lived in the north and along the eastern seaboard. The west remained relatively low in population, although there were some fairly large communities on the northwest coast as well. But they were not anything like as big as those along the north and the northeastern coast. There was one right in the center, which developed in the last 1,000 years or so. That was a very central point. And this was a very large city that was built purely to harness the power of the earth. This was built by the people who understood these things, the priests and people like that, people who thought they could handle this energy. The main development in weaponry came from the eastern cities and this one central place. This was possibly where the most scientific knowledge was based, rather than the knowledge around the temples and the priests. There were many experienced scientists, particularly in this central city. It was built especially for them to work there and to harness this very powerful energy. and they were developing weapons that were very bad indeed. A lot of them never came to fruition, for although they had the energy and understood it, they did not understand it quite well enough to be able to control it. They could harness it, yes, but in a very erratic manner. And they realized, and they were fighting very hard to make that final step to have a controllable energy, totally controllable, with which they could destroy people whom they thought they were enemies. With which they could destroy people whom they thought were their enemies. But it tended to backlash a little, and was very unstable, so they could not and never did manage to control that instability. So, although, yes, weapons did exist, very terrible weapons, they were rarely used, for they could harm the operators as much as the people they were trying to aim at or destroy. The central city was called Sandoros. It was built on the earthquake line which destroyed the city of Thrombis in Elena's time, and was a very powerful point because there was a crisscross of energy lines there, very, very powerful earth lines. This, for the scientific establishment, was very attractive, and they gravitated towards there. They had a central point within this city. It was built in a circular manner, with everything radiating out in concentric circles. The streets, the houses, and the buildings. Right in the center was this energy point, and it was immensely powerful. They augmented this with crystal and their own methods for summoning power. The corruption was not just in this central city, but in other places too. This came about for the same reason, that certain men and women wanted power over others. In whatever way they did it, the ultimate idea, the pattern of what they did, was much the same, the desire of one person to control another. There were very powerful people, rich people, who could buy what they wanted. They could buy power, they could buy military, they could buy and bribe anyone they wished to have power over others. And they saw the gaining of power almost like leeching other people's energy. It fed into them and made them stronger. This happened in all the places of corruption to a slightly lesser or greater extent, depending on the individual situation. Course, where you get one powerful man feeling using power to control others, you always get another one feeling he can do it better, and will perhaps go and kill that first man and take his power. Therefore, the corruption will spread. They will bend the rules. They will destroy their enemies by whatever means they can in order to get this energy. 4. It has an addictive quality. Within the healing sanctuaries, and anyone who does healing even now, knows it is a nice feeling to feel that energy flowing through your body. It gives you what you would normally term these days as a high. It makes you feel good. Imagine that multiplied many, many times. It is the most wonderful feeling for the human frame to feel, and once it is experienced, it is much enjoyed. But the healers understood that this power was given them for a very good reason, and they could use this. They could control it, for the energy through spirit and from the earth was used for its intended purpose, and therefore allowed itself to be controlled and channeled. The healers were very strong people, but they had the characteristics and understanding and were humble enough to realize that it was not their power, they were simply using it, and they understood this well. Therefore, it was used to the right ends. The energy is felt by everyone in much the same way. Someone with a darker character will think, I like this, and I want more of it. I can use this to control and manipulate. I can use this personal power and energy to gain money, to gain position, to gain standing. I can use it to control others and have them do what I want. Of course it can be used in this way, but it is wrong. Through this, it becomes like a monster. The more power they have, the more they desire, and they are channeling it through themselves into the wrong places. The negativity comes back to them, and they counteract this with more power. For now, they have learnt to do this, and the whole thing begins a downward spiral. Whereas with the healing energy, that is an uplifting spiral and a beautiful thing, which helps a person. With the negative side of it, it ultimately can destroy the person doing it, or make them into a very evil character indeed. Paul asks, what were the events in the last years that led to the destruction? Albani replies, at some point, someone realized that there were great beds of crystals within the mountains. Within your account of Jawleigh, you rightfully referred to one as the Sacred Mountain. These had power, incredible power. The ones who wished to control desired this very much, and set their will in motion to acquire it. At the same time, the scientists and others in the central city were also working on this. They had crystals they could use, large ones, and they were on a very, very sensitive earth point. Initially, their intentions were simply scientific research and to learn about these things, but corruption entered there also, and the negative energy started to feed into that giant crystal which was on the earth point. This in itself could be countered by the earth to some degree, but once the others started falling, the large power centers within the mountains themselves, then it became more and more difficult for the earth to maintain energy that was good for the land, and somewhere deep inside, it was decided that this must stop. The earth decided to disrupt this energy field completely and destroy the land that was causing it. As you rightly found in your Jawleigh past life regression, the oracles of the time knew this. They spoke of it. They predicted it for some years before the actual destruction, for they could feel the earth, they could sense her thoughts, and they knew. She tried to warn the people. She tried to warn them to stop what they were doing, but by then it was far too late. They would not listen. They were mad for the power. They were all taken. Then it was simply a very short time before the energy coursing through these very giant beds of crystal was very negative and bad indeed. That was when the earth destroyed the connections and destroyed the land. The actual destruction started at that central point, for that was a point that was most easy to break apart. In a very similar manner to what happened to the Crystal War, to what happened in the Crystal War, the crystal beds, in a way, to use a modern term, went into a critical state. The earth pumped so much energy through, as much energy as she could, and this was completely uncontrollable. This began to split the earth apart. It began to split the crystal bed, and that in itself created a vibration along the weakening lines of the earth, the earthquake belt, the fault line, and it began to move. But not only that, the energy caused a form of implosion, and that again created a large vortex, a vortex of energy, almost like a vacuum, as something which would suck energy in. This, joining with the movements of the fault lines, was so intense that nothing could survive it. The whole plate containing the continent began to shake itself apart. Parts of it were being pulled in one direction, and parts of it were being sucked inside, and others were moving in yet another direction. This was very deliberate. This was done so that the mass of the rock, mountains, and the mass of everything that contained this continent would shake apart and fall inwards. It split lengthways as well as horizontally, roughly. This took some time. The whole destruction took about 3 weeks, but in that time the earth movements were the most violent imaginable. The earth was moving at a tremendous rate. It was shaking, it was trembling, mountains were falling, the land was being torn apart and falling in on itself. When these fault lines opened under the sea came in. The water, as you can imagine, for this was an ocean we're talking about, vast amounts of water, flooded in through these fault lines and shaking land and simply destroyed it. Not only were the mountains falling, but also the ocean levels were rising. It was complete destruction. This caused a huge shockwave around the earth. No part of the earth escaped the shock and the tremor of it, although some were fairly minor because they were a long way away, but it was a massive, massive effect upon the earth's surface. The sea took a long time to settle down. There were tidal waves and various other things associated with that. There were high winds, hurricane force winds that were all created by that massive movement and falling of the land. Climatic change did not necessarily take place at that point. It has occurred at other times. The main thing that affected the water levels were the fact that there was a large hole where the land used to be, and the water had to fill that space. Therefore, around the world in general, the water levels dropped slightly. Paul asks, what was the outcome for the world civilization when the Atlantean continent went down? Alberni replies, the Atlantean population was completely destroyed. Relatively few survived, as well you know, the ones who had fled in advance and listened to the warnings. But from a population of many, many millions, it was only a very small handful. The physical effect upon the lands bordering around what you now call the Atlantic, although it was not quite the same then, they suffered tidal waves, very high seas, and very strong gales, winds. There was a certain amount of atmospheric dust created. Therefore, there was a darkening similar to what you get with the volcanic eruption. But this was relatively small. It happened in the way the wind took the debris from the destruction. That tended to be northwards. It tended to come north, for the bulk of the continent was north of the equator. There was relatively little effect upon the actual population of the world, apart from those in the coastal areas that had to suffer the effects of the tidal waves and gales. There was some atmospheric disturbance, like freak storms, major storms, something like that. The people who did not know of the existence of Atlantis, would have just put it down to some other force of nature. It caused some degree of electrical storms also, but that was relatively isolated, and only in certain areas. Paul asks, you have mentioned about uranium on Atlantis. Alberni replies, there was a high density of uranium upon Atlantis, and this increased the explosive effect of the destruction. But we are talking about natural things here, rather than man-made. And therefore, the Earth can control this, and control the effects of this very strong substance. It was rich with uranium, particularly in the north. Yes, it did add to the destructive element involved. Paul asks, what was the legacy left behind by the destruction of Atlantis? Alberni replies, the ones who escaped from Atlantis were mainly the more educated, and shall we say, more sensible people who had listened to the Earth energy. Therefore, they were sensitive to this, but they were very, very low in numbers. Where they went, they started other foundations of civilizations. Some of these are well known. Some of them have never been found or known about. The one, which is most well known, is the ancient Egyptian civilization. But we are talking now of a period again of several thousand years. Over that time, the knowledge gets corrupted. It gets changed and becomes in some ways inaccurate, for other things creep in. Although the essence of the knowledge was contained for some time, eventually it began to get lost. This happened in most of the places where the Atlanteans landed. They went northwards to the northern continents. They went to what is now the Northern American continent and founded cities and civilizations there, which are little known about. A lot of knowledge was passed down. A lot of the written knowledge was lost. It was passed down in oral tradition after that. But this becomes bent with time. It becomes exaggerated with time, altered. 'Tis the nature of humans to do this. However, a lot of this knowledge was quite true to the original. This is where you often find a lot of the old legendary things come from. They are coming from real knowledge from the past. Now you are beginning, at the start of the new millennium, to discover a lot of what you thought, I mean you in the general sense, as legend, fanciful stories, complete fantasies, are actually based on fact. It is based on real memory and reality, but a reality very, very different to your current one. The Atlanteans themselves were very, very sensitive people. The continent was so alive, so vibrant. The people there were equally like that. They could sense those energies quite normally. They have what you now refer to as psychic ability. It was considered pretty normal. Anyone who couldn't sense these things were regarded as a little odd or strange, as opposed to the reverse of what is happening now. Again, this sensitivity has been handed down through some people, through some genetic lines, but it is very much weakened from what it was. For I do not think the earth has produced another land quite so rich as Atlantis. I think the earth probably realizes that people are not mature enough to control these vast powers. People are not mature enough to understand them and use them for good. Therefore, the opportunity has never been presented again. For even now, could you imagine with today's technology and knowledge, and look at what you see around you, you see greed, you see corruption, you see angry people, you see the desire to take over land from others, aggression, war, destruction. With the power Atlantis held, that would lead to another very large problem. People still have not matured. People are foolish animals. They do not have the knowledge or the capacity to handle the vast power that would give them. They would still become corrupt and evil. There are some who would not, of course. There are some who would handle this beautifully and bring about great gains for others. There are still the healers. There are still the academics who understand. But on the whole, especially the people who favour the military, which is still very strong in some places, you only have to look at recent developments within your world history and imagine what would happen if they had the power and energy that was available in the Atlantean continent. They would destroy themselves and everyone else. Paul asks, what about the positive side of the Atlantean culture? Albani replies, the beautiful side of Atlantean life was the incredible strength of the healing ability of people there. Those who trained as healers were very, very different to the people you have in your medical profession now. They had skills. They had abilities that were all-encompassing and very, very complete. They had abilities that you can only dream about now. That is the positive side of this. If people could harness that and not the other side, then there could be great benefit. The people who are learning healing, like yourselves, are learning a tiny, tiny part of what the Atlanteans had. You've only got to access some of these healing lives that you have been doing, and you realize what abilities these people had, and almost took for granted. They learned, like any other profession, all these skills and technical abilities which you consider quite magical and amazing. It was just part of their everyday work. They could heal the mind, they could heal the soul, they could heal the physical body, in ways which modern medical science can only dream about. It is possible, hopefully, with a great deal of learning and training, to find these skills again, and to harness these abilities. Of course, nowadays, when someone comes out with things like this, they are considered strange, a quack, one might say, or even a fraud. People do not believe. A lot of people do not even believe that healing energy exists, so it is a very difficult thing to push forward. It would be wonderful if those abilities that the Atlantean healers had could be harnessed again. That would make a very beautiful contribution to this world. That side should also be emphasized, for there were many good people in Atlantis as well. They seemed to be overwhelmed by the negativity and the darker side, but they did exist, and it is certainly worthwhile remembering that. Postscript. During my regression sessions to Jawley, I was unaware of this central city of Sandoris. Whether Jawley was unaware of its existence, or whether his knowledge regarding the city just didn't come to my consciousness during the regression, I am not sure. I know that Jawley's focus of attention was very much connected to the northern part of the continent. The sacred mountain was inland in this region. The central city of Sandoris must have been a vast distance further away. Chapter 19. Soul Connections. One of the most fascinating and transforming aspects of writing this book has been the discovery of the breadth and depth of the soul connections that exist between Linda, Denise, Lynn, and myself. At the beginning of my research into Atlantean past lives, I had no idea that these existed. More and more, for all of us, the awareness of this has grown and has changed our lives. In general, I feel it is very likely that for at least most of us, we travel through our unfolding journey as souls in a group. So we are not alone, and we can help each other learn. There may be a group of us that start our incarnations together, and the connection will always remain strong. Then there may be the possibility, through love, of establishing bonds with other souls, so that they may also accompany us on our soul journey, leading to an expansion of consciousness. Through my regression experiences with clients, I have come to believe that it is possible for souls to incarnate on many other worlds beside Earth, and so the potential for gaining soul experience from physical incarnation is vast. But I feel there is a beginning, and there also may be the moment when lessons have been sufficiently learned so that physical incarnation is no longer necessary. With Denise, Linda, and Lynn, I feel that they are my soul friends, and that we have been together since our beginning as souls. We have not always incarnated together, but very often I feel we have chosen to do so. Each of us has taken on particular characteristics and individual pathways of learning, but as souls we have tried to support each other with this. During various physical incarnations, it seems that at times one or more of us have made big mistakes, but the mutual dedication to each other has remained. On Atlantis, the four of us were incarnated together many, many times. The relationship patterns we shared varied tremendously. And there were also periods of Atlantis history where we did not incarnate together. I know, for instance, that there was a period of some thousands of years where in the early stages of Atlantis' history, I left Atlantis altogether and had lives elsewhere. I largely did not share these lives with our group of four. There was another shorter period after my Commander Arune life where I did much the same thing. However, for the remaining time of Atlantis' history, when I was living lives there, I was very closely bonded to the other three members of the group. We know that all these lives exist as a shared memory within our minds, and so nowadays it does not take much for the memory from a particular past life of one of us to trigger very easily experiences from that same lifetime of another member of the group. However, just because we are close as soul friends, it does not mean that we have always got on very well together in physical incarnation. Often as souls, we would deliberately place ourselves in very challenging relationships with another member of the group to help each of us learn how to cope with a particular situation. Because of the very close soul bond that we all share, then when we met with one of the other members of the soul group during our physical incarnations, this would tend to make a big impact upon us. Therefore, this would help us focus upon what we needed to do. Unfortunately, as souls, we have not always coped very well with the lessons we have needed to learn. Consequently, often the people we have hurt and maimed and tortured and killed most have tended to be members of our own soul group. This then has sometimes caused problems for us in our relationship with each other. During her incarnations on Atlantis, Linda went through a very difficult patch, where she stopped learning her lessons and kept making similar mistakes through one life after another. Here, the pivotal life was Sophira. In subsequent lives, the members of the group gathered during Linda's lives to try to help her change. During Tasha's life, I as Commander Aruni, Denise as a child, and Lynn as a mother, all appeared in Tasha's life as potential victims, but also with the potential that we could help Tasha to open her life to live with more compassion, rather than hate and anger. We did not quite manage. From the Sophira incarnation, my relationship with Linda's soul was disturbed, as was the relationship between Lynn and Linda. In subsequent lives, there were many triangular situations where I tended to favour Lynn over Linda because of a deeply felt abhorrence I continued to carry related to the Sophira episodes. These lives often ended destructively and added to the problems. In recent months, the three of us have been working hard to clear the disturbances relating to these lives and our relationship together. So now things are much easier and more loving between us as a result. It is remarkable how, in spite of all the hurt and cruelty the four of us have imparted upon each other in past lives, now in our present lives, as we have met again, there is a genuine closeness between us and a love to be together. We feel that in our present life we have met to work together and to combine our energies in a positive way for healing and helping others. We have found, as we have all become more aware of the bond that exists between us, that we have felt ourselves naturally drawn together, attracted to want to spend more time with each other. The depth of contact that exists has meant that we have been catalysts for each other to continue to learn more deeply about ourselves and release deeply held patterns. With our present life relationships, because of the very close soul bond the four of us feel with each other, some of the other important relationships we have had with people have not seemed as significant anymore. This has created problems we have had to overcome, and big tests for all of us. Inevitably, there has been some shifting in our relationship patterns as a result. Although I have been emphasizing the closeness of the four of us, I have been aware that really the four of us are but part of a much larger soul group, and we have been like a little unit within that. I feel also that there are other souls with whom I have shared many lives in Atlantis, and with them there is a deep and loving bond, just as with Linda, Denise, and Lynn. This, I feel, is an individual process too. There are souls with whom I have had a very close contact, but who have not been so close to either Linda, Denise, and Lynn, and so they have their own orbit of close soul friends as well. So it is a more complex pattern and more multidimensional than it first appears to be. There have been people I know now who I sense were present in many of the lifetimes mentioned in this book. However, I have not mentioned their names for privacy reasons. In the end, I feel that the soul patterns of how we wish to travel through our various physical incarnations is up to us and what we want to create. We have a lot of choice and can be more on our own or more with others. I do feel that love is one of the key cornerstones of what is necessary for our soul to learn, and that means learning to link with others in peace. For me, it gives me a lot of joy and satisfaction to know that I belong within a soul family. I know that for me, Linda, Denise, and Lynn are part of that family with me. But not all. Chapter 20. Other Lives. In choosing the lifetimes regressions we have for including in this book, we have had to be extremely selective. Because we have wanted to convey pictures and understanding of the main historical junctions of Atlantis's history, we have had to choose lifetimes that were relevant to this. In addition, because we have also been writing from the perspective of how these regression experiences can be pertinent to inner personal growth, this has been another criterion which we have had to take into account. However, in making our decisions, there have been many, many regression experiences from this fascinating continent and our connections to it, which we have had to leave out. There have been numerous healing lives detailing some of the intricate healing practices of Atlantis. Some of these lives have been quite adventurous. There is one where Linda was an oracle channeling the Earth spirit. In a further experience, Linda lived as an astrologer in Atlantis. There are lives connecting with people's relationships to the plant and animal kingdoms, and many about the use of crystal power. There are some interesting psychological lives connected with soul growth, and also some quite diabolical lives where things went wrong. From the Golden Age, there are several inspirational lives from a time when Atlantean society functioned really well. There is one life where I was a pirate, and another where I was a fanatical priest. Linda and I have both had lives living in the central city of Sandoris, and there have been many more. Altogether, there is easily enough material for a second volume, which we could write about Atlantis. If the interest is there, then we will do it. Chapter 21. Conclusions. From our regression, and with Albani's channeling, I have speculated that there may have been hundreds of millions of people living on Atlantis at the time of its destruction. That is a lot of souls. Even if some of them have moved on, I imagine that many of these souls are incarnated on Earth today. The accounts that we have presented in this book represent the shared memory of four of us, Linda, Denise, Lynn, and myself, plus a few others whose inner responses have corroborated our findings. We have used the teachings of Albani, Linda's spiritual guide, to gain a wider perspective and found this to be helpful. We cannot be certain that this, what we have presented, represents a true history of Atlantis, but we have tried to be as honest as we could. When we have found inconsistencies, we have been quite ruthless between us to try to get at the truth, even if that could be emotionally very difficult. We have had to approach our learning about Atlantis and our relation to it step by step. It has been a dual process of learning about the continent itself and the life of its people, and at the same time learning about ourselves. It is not something that we have been able to do in a detached way. At times it has felt that our research involved every fibre of our nervous system. The result has changed each one of us involved considerably from when we started. In the way that this exploration has led to massive personal growth for all of us, I feel confident similar results could be attained for others who are willing to undergo these explorations too. We imagine that memories may be triggered for some readers of this book, and we are willing to offer our support if possible. Also, we welcome feedback and further thoughts regarding our findings, so the knowledge of this subject can be shared and increased. However, we caution anyone undergoing Atlantis past life explorations that this may not be easy. We have called this book Atlantis the Dark Continent for good reasons, in that nearly everyone I feel who has lived lives on Atlantis is bound to have had lives rather on the dark side, and these experiences are difficult to allow. We recommend anyone seeking to do this work to gain the support of a trained and experienced therapist to help you. There still feels to be much that is unknown to me about Atlantis, both on a personal level and about the place itself. It seems so vast and mysterious. There is an aura of awesome power and energy about it. So many legends have sprung from thoughts of Atlantis. Yet, it may be comforting if there are soul memories and spiritual records of what took place on Atlantis. So all is not lost. Perhaps there is a reason for these memories to come to the surface again today. If we can learn from them, then we may not make the same individual and collective mistakes again. Oh, oh, yeah, my boy.
You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.